An online survey that we had posted for 8 weeks, I think. 8 weeks. And we took that down on March 15th, trying to compile results so that we can share that information for others, with others. And sort of the next big public involvement process is we have a community meeting April 10th, right here in this room, starting at 6, at which we will review sort of the preliminary recommendations, get some sense of whether people feel we're on the correct trend or not. Then we will go to a Planning Commission work session first week, first Thursday in May, Planning Commission hearing, third week in May, and actually we have, just learned today, we have a work session with Council scheduled for April 24, just to update them on where we are with the process. We had originally hoped the Council would be able to have a hearing on the plan and act on it in June. We will have to see if that is still possible because they changed their meeting schedule. Instead of meeting once a week, they are now meeting twice a month. So they have not yet looked ahead and developed a schedule that goes that far in advance of the hearing. But hopefully sometime in June, we will have action on the master plan update. I would say it is an update. We are not revisiting the guiding principles, the vision for the farm at all. But we are trying to reflect some of the changes that have occurred and get a current sense of what people feel are priorities for the farm. From the historical perspective, really two main inputs into the plan are the interpretive trail plan, which was developed in 2011, I think, thanks to a grant through this commission. And that identified a series of stations that interpret sort of both the pioneer history, the history as a poor farm, and the history as an experiment station. Last fall, you probably reviewed the Farm Preservation and Maintenance Plan, which really looked at the 10 historic attributes of the farm, the 8 historic structures, Hazeldale Park, and the general landscape of the farm, sort of the pastoral landscape. And really the master plan does not alter any of those inputs. It's really a question moving forward of budget prioritization. And how are recommendations currently shaping up? Well, first I mentioned we are going to be kind of reflecting changes that occurred at the farm. And I'll probably switch between, this is current master plan, current uses, so this is what we're revising. This is kind of what's on the landscape today. The first thing that happened originally, the extension of Hazeldale Park was slated to be up in this area. However, we decided it was probably better to have it fronting 68th Street for access. It's also flatter terrain down here. So that has been moved to that location. Unfortunately, that significantly affects the community learning center that was originally proposed in the plan. A couple of things about the community learning center. One, at the time the plan was originally adopted in 2010, there was the community voiced a strong need for some sort of community meeting place. I think Luke Jensen Sports Park was developed since then and has filled that void quite a bit. And other elements of the learning center might be able to be accommodated either by reuse of some of the historical buildings. Specifically, there is the main administration building, and you have the milk house and the garage. That has been suggested for potential reuse as additional classroom space for small classes. The multi-use building, which we don't have a precise footprint. Based on the input we received so far, there's lots of people that would like lots of additional programs and classes, also a certain event space, which all might be accommodated through that multi-use building at some point in the future. But the detailed planning for that is quite a way off, and we would probably need to venture some sort of private partnership to really make that happen, if we're looking at something that is like a flex space or something, so you could adapt it to the various uses. The cemetery, this is the footprint as we knew it back in 2010, and concurrent with the interpretive trail plan, there was a remote sensing study which demarcated the more accurate boundaries of the cemetery. So that would be reflected in the master plan as well. The living farm, which was basically identified more as sort of a demonstration area for a green building design, was actually built on a different parcel off of, I think it was off of 88th Street. And so that is not something that we propose to stick with at this point in time. There was an historic silo, which is laying on its side up in this area in a state of disrepair. The council decided it was not worth it to repair and erect that silo else on the property. Although it is an historic silo, it is not one of the historic attributes of the farm because it was imported off-site from another farm in the county. It's just not advisable to try and find a use for it in its current state of repair. Since the adoption of the master plan, we do have the new parking lot, which is also an area that demonstrates different pervious pavement types of uses to manage stormwater. And since the adoption of the master plan, we have a high tunnel that is now here that is used for agricultural research by Washington State University Extension, and there's also a new greenhouse that was built up in that area. So those are kind of the changes at the farm that the new plan would acknowledge in the concept. Concepts that were affirmed are the interpretive trail with some modifications. As you can see, it wanders quite a bit over the landscape. The recommendation at this point is to keep the interpretive trail, to maintain the interpretive stations, maybe also add some interpretive signage about some of the ongoing agricultural operations, agricultural history, et cetera, of the county. But is also a recommendation to move that out to the perimeter. So instead of wandering across the landscape, you're probably looking at it, you know, something eventually cutting through the park and really staying mostly on the perimeter, both to respect steep slopes so it can be as accessible as possible and also to avoid wetlands because we don't want the permitting and costs to go with impacts to the wetlands. The Central Gravel Road, which did have an interpretive station at one point, is going to be pretty much restricted as a service road for the property. I think the interpretive station was kind of an overview of the farm. It may be that we would relocate that up in this area as you have a view down the hill that overlooks where most of the active agriculture is ongoing. And certainly access from 68th Street, where there currently is no access, would be coordinated with the update to the, well, not the update, the actual initial master plan for the expansion of Hazel Dell Park. The viewpoint, the high ground is up in this area. I think this is where the existing master plan shows the viewpoint. That is to be retained. I think there was two things. One of the questions we asked in the survey is, what are the things that would bring people out to the farm, because we feel a major obstacle to gaining greater support for the farm is to get more people out there to experience it. And they said the interpretive trail and the viewpoint would be the things that would get people out as often as once a week, over 50% of the respondents to the survey, which was not a scientific survey, so it's a self-selected group, but they said those were important amenities that they would like to see on the farm and would certainly help raise the visibility of the farm. Cougar Creek enhancement, which is proposed in the existing master plan, that will be carried forward. And we will continue to allocate land for agricultural uses through the farm use proposal process, which is reviewed by the Farm Advisory Committee for compatibility with the vision and the operating principles for the farm. That is their primary mission. That also retains flexibility as, for example, WSU is doing some cover crop research here. At some point in the future, that may be leased out when that experiment research is done for another agricultural use. And we would try to have leases that articulate the extent of the uses on the farm and the terms of the leases, which at this point are very minimal since the farm users are primarily nonprofit organizations. And the outdoor classroom, I think we're still looking at an outdoor classroom, which would be maybe a small grass-type amphitheater, something like that, in this general area. In terms of the Farm Advisory Committee recommendations that may be of historical interest, they came out and said they would like to restore one of the smaller current buildings, like the milk house or the garage, up in this area for some classroom space. I think that's one of the reuses contemplated in the Farm Preservation and Maintenance Plan. They would like to restore one of the historic structures, either the hog barn or the bunkhouse in that area, which is interesting to display some of the past and current farming practices and farming machinery. So they sort of another sort of experience for people to get back to some of our agricultural roots. And they also suggested maybe holding living history tours like are carried on at Fort Vancouver and other places to explain some of those activities. Very important, they felt a need to develop a marketing tool that what goes on at the farm, how people and groups can interact with it. Really, it's raising the visibility of the farm in general, which in turn would support a lot of the concepts for the farm. In terms of financial strategy, really I think raising the visibility is probably the most important thing. Once you're able to do that, we can look at corporate sponsorships, we can look at event revenue, certainly donations, grant writing, public-private partnerships, and take another look at fees for services. Currently, for example, the food bank leases 10 acres for $75 an acre per year, so that's $750 for a year. Not a lot of money to provide the level of support that we do in terms of agricultural support at the farm. So we'll take another look at those things and see if there are other fee structures that may bring in some additional revenue that has been clearly articulated by the council that they're hoping to reduce general fund demands on that is generated at the farm.
Do you have a total cost for running the farm every year?
We have some records. And they vary by year depending on what sort of activities. So, for example, 2011 was a fairly expensive year because that's when we rehabilitated the administrative buildings to accommodate the Washington State University Extension offices. But generally, if you include kind of our contract with Washington State University Extension, which We locate them at the farm. We don't charge them rent for the space at the farm. But that is sort of the bargain with the state extension services, so that we have an agricultural extension program in the county. Virtually all the agricultural extension programs have some sort of local support. That's the type of support. But if you include all those costs, you're roughly between, what was it, 600,000 and 700,000 a biennium? Was that it? Or was that annual? Yeah. But we had presented that information at the council work session, and certainly they expressed their concern about it and hoping to reduce that general fund draw.
I was going to ask, you made reference to Cougar Creek.
Yes.
And I was looking it up. I couldn't figure out, where does it run?
I think it's better on this.
Tell me, how about the flow there? Is that the 78th Street side?
This is the 78th Street. Yeah, 78th Street. This is 68th Street. This is the eastern property boundary, kind of, that starts, you know, just off the map. And it's kind of a drainage ditch, an agricultural drainage ditch through the property here. It's, you know, maybe 4 to 5 feet wide and, you know, 3 or 4 feet deep. As you move under 78th Street, it goes under 78th Street through a fairly significant culvert, and then it becomes a more defined stream on the 78th Street past that side.
Trying to imagine.
And Cougar Creek then goes down and enters Salmon Creek at the Salmon Creek Greenway. It's not a large stream, but
Does it start in that marshy area by St. John's?
Yeah, probably. That's kind of the origins up in that area.
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah.
But that seems like it'd be a nice thing to, a nice feature.
Yes. Yes.
So on the website, the Heritage Farm Advisory Board recommendations, the ideas or concepts, so those are just being folded into the master plan, and then are they acted upon just based on time and funding available? The things like the learning center and the outdoor classroom?
Yeah, I think it largely, after the concepts are embodied in the plan, it becomes really a programming and budget prioritization exercise. As we try to attract resources to the farm. And we are fortunate in that Laura here was recently appointed as kind of our grants person in parks, which is something we have never had. So it's a resource that hopefully will be able to identify and help us gather more resources for the farm and move forward as priorities are articulated.
What are you looking for tonight from our commission?
It was just an update, answer any questions that you may have. I know obviously it's a significant historical feature in the county, and we just wanted to make sure that you were up to date on where we were in the process.
I guess along the lines of wondering, when we were looking through your list, if you wanted some sort of thoughts from our commission on priorities.
Sure. If you have some thoughts for priorities, I think that's very helpful for us.
I had a question about the silo that you had mentioned that was dilapidated and fallen on the property. When was that silo brought to the site?
Ooh, I want to say early 2009, 2010.
I think it was like 2000. It was early 2010s, I think. As you guys look for grant opportunities, you probably already know, but the preservation plan had a list of opportunities or resources to look for, at least on the rehabilitating side of the structures. And then there's definitely the Heritage Capital funding through the legislature. It's, you know, it's kind of timing, but I think it's coming up for application maybe next year. So it's of this so the next, it would be the next one. So, but it takes a lot of effort to kind of make it, put it all together. So that would be something I would suggest looking into as you plan for some of the restoration of the buildings.
Okay.
Yeah. Good to know.
I mean, my feedback is that all of these look like good concepts for the continued viability of that property and to make it more of a revenue generating site and help cover the expenses. I think as the Historic Preservation Commission, we'd be more interested as some of these things develop to make sure that they are consistent with the historic property that infringing upon any of the contributing characteristics and so forth. As you probably will know, I don't see anything in any of these concepts that really stand out as something that I would call a red flag, you know, or something that might infringe upon that. It really depends on how you go about it, and then I'm sure when the time comes, it could be coming before the commission or...
Certainly, if we're going to try and reuse any of the historic structures, we need to come before the commission.
Do you have anything to add?
No, I'm just interested in the Cougar Creek Trail part. I think that's in a different spot. That's what I was thinking. So thank you for that explanation.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, just thank you and... we appreciate the support you've provided for the farm today. We've got a couple of the interpretive panels completed, the interpretive trail plan, the cemetery remote sensing study. I mean, you've been very, very, very helpful to moving the farm master plan towards implementation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is the public hearing.
I'm going to apologize to everyone. I have allergies and I can't hear out of one ear tonight, so I feel like I'm being loud, but I could be really quiet, so let me know if I need to speak louder. The public hearing is on the nomination to the Clark County Heritage Register for Parkersville Landing, and we'll start with staff.
Thank you. I'm just going to give a brief overview from the staff report. So the nomination to the Clark County Heritage Register for Parkersville Landing Site, located off State Route 14 on the Columbia River in Washougal, Washington. The site has figured prominently in the state's history. There are Native American artifacts in the Kamish-Washougal area on the Parker's Landing Historical Site. The site was added to the National Register of Historic Places and the Washington State Heritage Register in 1976 based on its archaeological value. And the site's now being nominated to the Clark County Heritage Register based on its historic characteristics. We've had British explorers there as early as 1792. Lewis and Clark passed through in 1806. And the primary local significance is David C. Parker, on whose land donation claim the site is located. Parker got there in 1854 and built a small dock called Parker's Ferry or Parker's Landing on the Columbia River. He died in 1858, and the Louis von Vliet administered his estate and then purchased a large portion of it. And platted Parkersville to allow for more growth, but due to challenges in property titles, Parkersville went in decline while Washougal started booming in the late 1870s. The Von Vliet family has three generations of history on that land, and upon the death of the third generation, the Kamish-Washougal Port took over in 1978. It's been operated as a 3.8-acre public park. And includes commemorative features. And staff found that the nomination met all three of the criteria. Let's see, so sorry. Okay, so namely, the findings are that it's significantly associated with the Chinook-speaking people. It's associated with David Parker, the first permanent American settler who came to the site in 1845. It's associated with three generations of the Van Vliet family from 1858 to 1978. And the site's period of significant dates make it obviously older than 50 years old. It also falls into three of the additional 11 categories. It's associated with events that have made a significant contribution to broad patterns of national, state, or local history. It's associated with the lives of persons significant in national, state, or local history. It's yielded, or more likely to yield, more important archaeological information related to history or prehistory. And then staff is recommending approval of this nomination.
Do we have any questions of staff? All right. Do we have the applicant here?
Good evening. Yeah, good evening. So I'm Brad Richardson. I'm the executive director at the Clark County Historical Museum, and we worked with the Parkersville National Historic Site Advisory Committee and the Port of Camas, Washougal, to put together this nomination for the site. I have Jack and Connie Wager here. They're our researchers that did the bulk of the research for the project. So I can go through the nomination if you'd like. So the Parkersville site that we identified is the historic Parkersville site, Parkersville Landing Historic Park, which is 3.88 acres, and that's including the park and parking lot and all of that, the facilities that are in the park area. And that's owned by the Port of Camas Washougal. And today's site is one that commemorates the Chinook-speaking Native Americans of the area. It also discusses the settlement and establishment by homesteader David C. Parker, and then later the stewardship by the Van Vliet family. The site was added to both the national and the state register, so this is the final register that this site is not included on at this time. And it was, at the time, included for its archaeological significance, but we focused on the historical connections of the site for the county nomination. There is a committee through the Port of Camas Washougal, the Parkersville National Historic Site Advisory Committee, which was formerly the Parkersville Landing Park Advisory Committee, and I just want to thank every one of those people who have continued to push this nomination forward, and they provided a lot of information for us to be able to accomplish this and a lot of background. And they provide input towards the management of this site, which is vital and important, and it's significant to them. So it's been great to see that. Over the years, the port has enhanced the site and added recreational facilities and educational elements such as pathways, benches, picnic tables, rose arbor, two plazas, an old silo base, a kiosk that hosts interpretive panels. You can see on the map here, we've tried to outline those items that are currently there in the park and give you a layout of the different sections. And basically each of those sections make up the area that we're working for the nomination. In our research, we went ahead and analyzed the site today. We took photographs and documented everything within measurements and documentation that we could, so that this nomination will also be a snapshot, not just of the historical significance, but what it looks like today. So future research will know what it looked like at this time. We were in our research based on the location of some from maps and photographs to identify the locations of the River Light, which used to stand at Parker's Landing, also the Brown and Braun Hotels and Saloon, and the original Parker's Landing Dock. And before going into this nomination, these were not definite in where they were located before. So we've actually located those, which provides potential for restoration or some kind of interpretive signage to indicate those previous things. When it comes to the significance of the site, we did identify significant events in records. It indicates that the birth of the first child of American immigrants in the area that would become the state of Washington happened in and around the site of Parkersville. We also have seen early Washington State and North Bank shipping history, and also Clark County and East Clark County shipping history. By 1870, steamboats and commerce activity was noted at the site. There was a dock at Parker's Landing. It became very important since the road travel to that location was not very tenable at that time. And an editorial from the Vancouver Independent in 1877 stated that they had two steamboats running in opposition two trips a week on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. It was also noted that there was a storehouse and there was commerce taking activity at the site. It's also one of the earliest East County and also North Bank sites where there was a platted town and began to grow out of there in the 1850s. And then the hotel that was there, and also Catalpa Grove, which was an event space where people would gather for celebrations, is also an early East County site that we were able to identify. The Brown Hotel, Fitz Brown, was also present at the site, and Brown went on to be a prominent figure in the history of Camas or of Washougal, and has held significance in that. It was also an early destination site for lots of events. There were indications that there were some events up to 1,000 individuals that came out to the Catalpa Grove, which was a part of the site. And then finally, one of the interesting facts was, because of the cloudy nature of the title and some disputes over land, it's indicated that some of the individuals that were in Parkersville moved to Washougal to avoid that, and actually fueled the growth and became important figures in the establishment of the city of Washougal. So the failure of Parkersville essentially helped bolster the success of Washougal by providing commerce and people who had established businesses. And this is evidence in Fritz Brown's building of a hotel and deconstructing his hotel and removing it to Washougal because he didn't want to deal with land disputes. There are significant individuals that are affiliated with the site. David C. Parker is the first permanent American immigrant to settle in the Clark County area with his family, and he established the dock at the site, Parker's Ferry, as Sharon had mentioned. We also have Louis Van Fleet, who was the administrator of David Parker's estate. He was an early leader that would in the area that would become Washington State. Van Fleet served multiple terms in the territorial legislature, representing Clark and Cowlitz County, so entire Southwest Washington, between 1856 and 1871. And in 1856, he was appointed the United States Deputy Surveyor, and he held that position for 40 years. He was also a land appraiser for the Northern Pacific Railway, a Mason, and a veteran of the conflicts that were known at the time as Indian Wars, so pretty significant individual. And he also added to the Parker plat and platted additional portions of the Parkersville. Finally, also, Louisa Wright was an early Clark County and Washington State physician, and she resided on the property. And she was also an early female candidate for public office. She was an early member of the Camas School Board, and then she was a candidate for mayor, which, and the historical note was that she lost by one vote from becoming the first female mayor of the city of Camas.
Campaigning.
She didn't even want to campaign. She's very modest. And so we feel, with the ties to those events for Washington State and Clark County history, also the individuals that left an impact on our community, that the site is eligible for nomination to the register.
I noticed on the plat map, we have reference to the name Van Fleet,
mm-hmm.
and then we have the Van Vliet. Are they the same people, or did the recorder get it wrong?
You saw it on
the spelling.
The spelling there is Van Vliet.
Yes, I get that. But
I believe it's misspelled.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah.
Correct.
I thought that was an interesting point.
Yeah.
So that's the same people.
Yeah.
Got it. Thank you.
Comments by one of our commissioners who's not here tonight. Did we enter it as an exhibit? Okay. Just wondering, so we'll have it as just an extra exhibit. So the comments from our commissioner, Alex Gall, he's an archaeologist, and what he wrote is, the nomination looks very thorough, almost too thorough, which I think is a good thing. It almost has too many things in it's incorporating into the nomination instead of focusing on the contributing elements, but it makes for good reading and drives the point home that the patch of land has a lot of history. Suggested edits are on, he has a list of suggested edits, page 9, apple trees section, it would read better if it said, actually, I'm going to need glasses here. One moment. Okay. Apple trees section said it would read better if it said, quote unquote, Van Fleet home burned in 1978 instead of, quote unquote, 1978 home. Mm-hmm. Page 11, under the river light section, the name is Jemtegard with a T, not Jemtegard. Needs changing throughout the document. Page 14, pre-contact section. First sentence, change, quote unquote, our to the region. Sounds disrespectful to say our region when referencing those who were here millennia before. The rest of that section is weak and could use reworking by an archaeologist. References could use some bolstering too. That's everything.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that and definitely can make adjustments to it.
All right. Do we have any other specific comments?
Yes. Okay. Well, there's always at least two sides to every story. And so I would say don't take Alex's comments too seriously. I thought this was a very well-written nomination, and I think, of course, there might be something lacking in the archaeological descriptions therein. I'll defer to Alex on that one. But the documentation, the references, the footnotes, everything just looks great, and all of the backup material, it's, you know, what we've kind of been pushing on the public and staff to kind of bring before us in terms of the quality of work. So this is great. I had a few questions as I was reading through the nomination. The first one was regarding pre-contact. And the first sentence there reads, Native peoples occupied our region for many centuries before European contact. It is estimated that in the 1700s, 15,000 Chinook-speaking natives inhabited the Columbia River region between the Dalles and the Pacific. Disease had lowered that number to about 15,000 by the time of Lewis and Clark. Yet this is really before any significant white settlement. So I was just kind of curious what the source of that disease and mortality was.
You know, I don't really answer that question. We know that there were some limited contacts by the Spaniards on the coast. Whether it was enough to pass along a disease, I kind of doubt. But, as well as people coming down through Canada, fur traders and such, that really undocumented that they wandered into the Great Plains states and west. But yeah. And then those diseases could have worked their way west.
And this is from recollection, I don't have the sources on it, but there was trading that was taking place pre to what's considered contact, which was significant contact, you know, the Lewis and Clark, John Broughton, and those periods. Mm-hmm. There are publications like Americana Pox that does discuss the smallpox and different diseases that traveled, and that there was evidence coming down, and it's believed based on very light early trading. I think sometimes Russian influences are applied to that, Spanish influences are applied. And again, I'm not speaking off of the empirical facts, but memory of some materials that I've read. But there is evidence in publications, especially the one Americana Pox, that does substantiate that there was significant loss of life pre to the significant contact period in the Pacific Northwest once you had American immigrants coming and settling. And we can provide more backup on that.
Interesting. Yeah, and I was also interested, I guess I had never fully realized that the American Fur Company or the Pacific Fur Company had actually traveled that far up the Columbia by that point in time. That would be John Jacob Astor's company that was founded in Astoria there, or at least based in Astoria for their operations. So that was interesting to me. I had a question in terms of settlers, Bush, Simmons, and Ow, okay, I got it wrong on two times.
His name was Howe, H-O-W-E, but he was British and illiterate, and so he dropped his H's.
Oh, right.
He's, what's your name? And you say, Richard Howe.
Right. So everybody signs him in as yeah. Howe.
By the time they figured it out, by the time it was too late to go back yeah. and change, so they're still known as Owls, and there's still some in that area.
Yeah, I get confused when I go to London. And so it mentions that Owl married White Wing, the daughter of a native leader who lived in the Washougal area. I would assume that that was, that she was Chinook? Okay. And do we know who the native leader was? Someone of some prominence? Interesting. Okay. I'm not necessarily suggesting that this be reworked. It's just interested in some clarification there. Then I had another question on Lewis Van Fleet. I think this is my last question. Move things on. Let's see. There was a comment that he had arrived from Seneca County, New York. He was a Mason. Do you mean to say, though, that he was a Freemason?
Yes.
Is that was, okay.
Yes. Not a bricklayer.
Right.
Freemason. Yeah.
Freemason. Okay. That wasn't clear. And did he become a Mason at a local lodge, or did he kind of bring that with him?
My guess is he brought with him.
Yeah, the records
didn't
indicate that.
I was just curious. I have no further questions.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? I would like to echo what Robert said about this report and the nomination. I really actually did enjoy reading all the details on the site and I found some of the stories about the keeping the light lit, you know, as the duties of those that first settled there really fascinating, actually. So I could imagine us, you know, hoping to sponsor something in the future for that, so that story could be told as well. But I didn't have any specific corrections that I would suggest that need to be made at this time. Michelle, do you have anything you'd like to?
Very nice job. Thanks for your hard work on it.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else that would like to speak on this? Oh, you guys were done with, and we were asking questions. Okay. I just realized I don't have my cheat sheet tonight. Is anyone else here to speak on this particular proposal?
Yes.
Okay. Just come on up to the mic and give your name for the record.
Green lights on. Green means go. Hi, I am Martha Martin. I'm one of the three people on the nomination forum that was part of the subcommittee. Jenny Frosch is also here this evening, and unfortunately Rosalie McCray could not be here. She was ill, but wanted to be. And Rosalie was one of the original people that worked on the process to get this site on the National Historic Register in 1976. So we're going back a long ways with how long this process has been going on. Part of the reason I have my camera here, but I've learned about history, and you document everything, even the current things that 50 years from now will be important, this moment, which is really thrilling, all the work and all of the people in the huge village that went into this. And we so appreciate being able to sit here in front of you in this moment in time. It's really historical. How about that? So the history of the process of getting this site protected is also part of something that you all probably need to know, and maybe do know already, that there were people that throughout history for the last 32 years have stepped up and worked with the port through all of its different commissioners, which, by the way, we have two commissioners here this evening from the port and the executive director. That's how important this is to them and how they support this. So it's really incredible that all of these people have stepped up and said, yes, we think this is fabulous.
Just curious, is there anybody here who worked on the nomination to the National Register back in 1976?
That would have been Rosalie, who she's probably, I don't know if you remember Roberta Tidland. Does that name sound familiar to you? She was probably the original person to get this going. And so she and Rosalie McRae, Bernice Plukas, I don't know if that name sounds familiar, Dave Buchholz, trying to think of all those people. There was a whole group of people. Roberta, right, Roberta Tidland. She'd passed away last year, year before last, not long ago, which was sad, but it was also part of our motivation for finishing this because she had wanted this done. So she's in this room. I'd be glad to answer any questions in regards to the citizens' support of all of this or how we worked on this and kept this momentum going and thanking these people. These people stepped up to help us. These people stepped up to help us. They carried the load, and we really appreciate them very, very much. I'm glad you're curious. Questions? Isn't that interesting to read these things?
Questions.
There was a lot of curious things that came up, weren't there?
Yeah. I don't think we have any questions right now. So we'll have anyone else would like to step up, provide comments?
Jenny, did you want to say something?
You'll need to, ma'am, you'll need to be on the microphone so that we can record you.
Not much, but I feel that it's a very important site.
Could you tell us your name?
Oh, Jenny Frosch. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
F-R-O-S-H. Everybody spells my last name wrong.
Okay.
So that's why I spell it out.
Thank you.
I've been on the committee for a long time, about 10 years. I feel that this is an extremely important site. I look forward to the time when we can have tourists come in by Sternwheeler and to be able to tour our historic site that was the beginnings of Washougal, the beginnings of way back in the 1800s. I just feel that there's so much potential here, and very few people know about it. And one thing I'd like to do is get the word out, and because there's so much, this small park is so special. To not only to me, but to everybody. And there's some people don't understand it or don't know about it. And I'd like to do all I can in the future to make this more public, what's going on here. And I think also the fact that I was really shocked because I thought when we started this whole project, it was only going to take a couple months.
Sorry.
I was really surprised. I'd like to say thank you to Martha because at one time I couldn't do it. It was in failing health. But I just feel that this is so, I feel so strongly about Parkersville, the history behind it, the people that really worked to make it successful, the steamships or the sternwheelers that came in here with like animals, pigs and cows and everything, to make this a thriving community in the 1800s. And then I think about it today and what we have and our heritage. And I don't want people to forget it. There's people new coming in this area that doesn't even know about Parkersville, doesn't know about the historic sites. Do everything I can to make sure that they understand how important it is as far as our community is concerned. And I'm very proud to be part of the committee.
Thank you. Do you have any comments or questions? All right. Anyone else like to speak?
I'm Bruce Furstberg, and I chair the advisory committee for Parkersville for the Port of Kalamazoo-Washougal. And I'm going to bring the dirty word up, Riverwalk. Everybody that's been in Clark County longer than 12 years remembers that nasty thing. And part of their deal was to get rid of our park. And that's been part of the goal by getting on this registry. One of the things we were fortunate enough was get new commissioners like Commissioner Ward and two others elected that we got the city of Camp Washougal to change the zoning for the park. And this is the final step. Then we figure we've got everything nailed down. So when all of us are gone, that park is still there, and that's our, been our ultimate goal right along, is to keep that park in perpetuity.
Thank you. Anyone else like to speak about this nomination, either for or against? All right, I'm seeing none. No? Okay. All right. So we'll bring it back to the commission. Deliberate. We'll close the public hearing portion. Do we have anything else we'd like to discuss on this nomination?
So in terms of deliberation comments, not really. This is as much of a slam dunk nomination as I've ever seen in front of this commission. It's already on the National Register. It is so rich with history. It's very well documented. I can tell that, you know, this is a lot of work and a very collaborative effort. So kudos to everybody who worked on this in the community. This is great.
It seems like it's a very valuable piece of Clark County history, and you can just see all the passion that people have put into it. So that's what it is.
Unfortunately, several of them, people that were really involved in this, like Roberta Tidlin, Ted Durgan, John Buchholz, are unfortunately no longer with us. But part of the goal.
Right, do we have any other comments from the commission? Otherwise, I'll entertain a motion.
I just wanted to say that two things that this document does that folks who have presented it may not realize is there's a gift to future applicants. And sometimes it's really great if you have a template of a truly excellent nomination form. And so that's one thing that the folks who went to all this trouble may not realize, that it will serve future applicants. And the other thing I wanted to let you know is that in applications such as this, we have in one document a repository of all the scholarship. And sometimes for students of history, and Brad and I can speak to this, that finding the sources is nearly impossible. And so this document not only puts forward your application to put this on the registry, it also provides a template for future applicants, but also it's the piece of historiography that might not exist had you not gone to all the trouble of making this application so wonderfully well. So I wanted to let you know that there's dividends to your efforts that you may not have considered. And I wanted to make sure you knew that that was really important too.
So I would move that the commission accept the nomination as is to the Heritage Register, and that we forward on Alex's comments to Brad, and with the simple request that you maybe add a little more texture to it as you deem appropriate, but I don't see anything lacking in this nomination that should hold it up. So I would move that we approve as is.
I second.
So with, now we can discuss your motion for a moment. So you, in your motion, did you intend to have the corrections that Alex has suggested?
No.
Corrections or?
No, I did not. So it's merely a request that his comments be taken into consideration as maybe an opportunity for improvement to this document, but it is not a requirement. I move that we approve the nomination as written.
All right. I guess I would say that I would feel better about supporting a motion that's more specific. I don't have any objections to fixing some of the edits about spelling, and I think you'll have a copy of this too.
Yeah.
And so that would take a few minutes. I wouldn't agree that any of these other sections need any additional work or research or anything like that, but I'd say just suggesting some of these edits are fixed would be a solid motion.
we'll actually be doing that anyways, because this document will be repurposed also for an exhibit on rivers, roads, and ports that we'll be doing at the museum and potentially published in our annual publication as an example of a nomination. So we're going to make these edits anyway. So that's no problem.
You're supporting them.
So are you amending the motion?
I'm offering an amendment to your motion.
And the amendment is just spelling correction?
Yes.
I would support that.
Can we vote on the amendments to the motion? I always forget.
Or we would right. Second.
Do I have a second for the amendments to the motion?
I'll make a second for the amendments to the motion.
Okay. Any other discussion on the amendment?
No.
All right, then. Do we have any more discussion on the motion as a whole? All right, then. So all in favor of the motion to approve?
Aye.
And I'm also aye. All right, and so we have no opposed. It's unanimous. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next business, now I'm loud again, okay, on the agenda are some updates. Well, how about we give 1 minute for everyone?
So on Monday, the HPC subcommittee met and interviewed 5 candidates and selected 2. We have to keep those names confidential because they still have to go through the city council and the county council. But we've made it. We forwarded a recommendation to council. Yes, just a second.
Just to add to that item for updates was I did review the letter and the 2 that are being forwarded to city council, and they've got impressive resumes, so I hope they make it through. And, They seem like they'd be a really valuable asset to the commission.
That's all I have on the subcommittee.
Very good.
Oh, that's good to know, too.
3 people we talked about.
Oh, good.
Okay. How did they perform on the test?
I don't know if we could, without being specific. Can she? I wasn't.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah. I guess you'll have to ask them in person when they're here. All right. Next item.
Sure. Robert, did you want to give an update on the National Main Street Conference or?
Yeah, sure. I can speak to the National Main Street Conference, and then I'd invite yourself and Jan to add anything if they may. So I spoke to Jan about this a little bit when I was up in Seattle. And I think my impression is that we're doing a really good job. So I attended a number of the conferences, and sometimes I'd, you know, stay in half of one of these sessions, and then I'd run to another session. And the key takeaway, I feel, is that, you know, we are pretty much practicing best practices in a lot of regards, especially with respect to historic preservation. Now, the Main Street Conference also overlaps into a lot of different areas. I learned from Allison Brooks's opening comments at the opening plenary that, you know, Washington State's situation is a little bit unique in that the Main Street program is embedded within the Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation. And so when we attend the statewide Main Street conferences, as we have been, those tend to probably be a little more historic preservation focused than maybe they would be on a national level. And then when you're there and you're participating with a number of people who are there from around the country, different formats, much of the programming is geared toward, you know, community planning and stakeholder management, business revitalization. So a little bit of it was some of it was outside of our immediate scope. One thing that I did think about was there was one session that was talking about, you know, branding of your Main Street program and your downtown historic district. And I spoke to Jan a little bit about this too, and maybe she can add some more color. But I understand that there have been some, you know, efforts to do that here within our own heritage overlay. But then subsequently, I was thinking, well, you know, the HPC hasn't necessarily been involved, and I know that, you know, through the process of election cycles over time, leadership changes, and sometimes maybe these efforts kind of change over time. So maybe there's an opportunity for the HPC to be involved in that going forward and helping to kind of shape the branding of downtown Main Street, Vancouver. Maybe add a little bit of consistency and provide a little bit of a more of the historical context to that. So that's an opportunity for improvement. But overall, I thought it was a great conference, and it was wonderful to be able to attend. Anything to add?
No, I thought it was a really well done conference, and almost every session I went to was well done and had lots of good information. The biggest dud was the one on mid-century, preserving mid-century buildings in your downtown, and she was super nervous, and I don't know, but
and that's a topic that we would
want. Yeah, so there was a historic preservation track, so I didn't go to all of those. I kind of bounced around between the art and culture and the Main Street and the civic leader and the but I was disappointed in that one because there was so much more she could have done with it, and she didn't even have the tax credit information correct. Someone had to call her on it. It's like, no, that's before they changed the law. So anyway, but most of the sessions I went to were really great. There was a keynote of a husband and wife that have flown their small plane all over the United States to small town America and have written a book about what they found about how, you know, sort of the resurgence of Main Street and of the downtowns and small towns.
More like blue skyways.
Yeah.
Blue highways.
Blue, right. My husband's reading Blue Highways again.
William Least Heat Moon.
Maybe since I brought it up, Jan, if you could add a little color in terms of the branding efforts that have been done and where the city's going with that.
Yeah. Well,
your thoughts if there's a role for the HPC there.
The Vancouver's Downtown Association led a coalition effort to bring in a consultant firm called Muldrow and Associates, who actually were at the Ellensburg Revitalized Washington that some of us went to. It's the session they had in the recliner section of the furniture store, which was creative. And they went through the branding process. So the new banners you see around downtown, let's say downtown Vancouver, that's the brand, that's Stacked logo. The problem, I mean, that we've run into is that now there's been a change in leadership in the VDA. They don't currently have an executive director, so they were sort of tasked with leading the charge and getting that brand more widely spread. And, you know, we have the new entry sign on 6th Street, and then we've got the streetlight banners, but I don't know that it's gone any further than that in terms of spreading the brand. But hopefully they'll get a new executive director, and that effort will take back off again. It doesn't look, the brand doesn't look very historic. But I don't think that was the goal.
So our next update is on the Cultural Resources Summit. And am I supposed to talk on this one? Okay, because I can a little bit.
Yeah, I think Alex, you spoke with him last.
Okay.
He's planning to attend, and he's going to contact the organizing committee to see if it can just be a discussion and not a panel. And it was just a about how we are going to do this study, and then next year we can reattend this or a different workshop and report on what we've done.
Yeah, I did reach out to them today because they were still, including me and all their, it almost looks like they're not getting any response from any other speakers because everything's in like capital letters, like, you know, deadline on responding to us speakers with your bios, and I thought, okay.
Written in there as like a panel, and so that's not what's happening, so.
Yeah, so I let her know that that I wasn't going to be there and that it would just be Alex. And then I did see an email that came out that
they're actually offering scholarships now to speakers, and so I hadn't had a chance. I think this was yesterday's email, so I was planning to talk again to Alex. I know that we've already have it in our budget, just so everyone knows. It was our last meeting that we already approved, at least two of us to go to the conference, but if we can qualify for a scholarship, then but I think it was yesterday's email, so I'm not sure what I clicked on the link and it didn't go anywhere, so it looked like I would have had to have called them. They're not as organized as you would have hoped, I guess, is what I'm saying, but I do know Alex was still planning to go.
Sean was originally going to go, right? And then he was like, I think I have too many things happening. Has anyone circled back to him?
Right.
To see if he's still.
The last time I talked to Alex was right before I got back a hold of you guys, and he was going to follow up with Sean.
Okay.
So I haven't heard from either of them other than, like I said, I've contacted the organizers because I was still on their agenda listed as a speaker, too, so I wanted to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the three of you are.
Yes. So I thought, well, you should probably know who's really showing up from our commission.
I remember the discussion. That was in January, right? Or
it was our last meeting. Yeah.
No, but it came up before that.
Oh.
I wasn't at the last meeting.
Oh, okay.
But could you remind me of when and where that is?
It's at the end of May.
21st.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's up north, and I don't have any of the details in front of me. It's a five-hour drive.
Kwame? Suquamish? Casino?
Snoqualmie?
Oh, yeah.
Snoqualmie Falls?
No. Snoqualmish, maybe? It's a casino. It's like on the west side of Seattle.
Way up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to go, but my work won't allow me to go. It'd be basically 3 days gone. So not enough people to do everything that needs to happen, and so I can't spare the time. But luckily, Alex is still going to go.
Okay, we'll keep coordinating with Alex and Sean, and we'll figure something out.
Demolition project update.
We don't have an update. This with the consultants just starting.
Okay. Well, I assumed if Alex was here, he might have had an update if they've been talking to him by email or anything. So, okay. PBRS update.
I just put it in a slideshow just to kind of be hopefully clear, and so we can all follow along. So, if you all remember, we talked about this, I think it was last fall, at the beginning, when I introduced that.
That
the county's looking at developing a public benefit rating system. And this would be to, so right now, the county has a current use open space taxation incentive program for protecting or providing a public benefit on sensitive lands and historic sites falls under that eligibility. So in recent, in the past year, we've been looking at replacing the current way we do it with a new rating system that would provide more flexibility of transitioning people out of categories. It was kind of began with a lot of the agricultural farmers who are retiring, and to be able to put them into a classification that didn't kick them out of a program and require them to pay the back tax penalty, but to transition them into a preservation farm where they would still be in a program. It wouldn't have the same huge benefit, but it would still have a value for them. So the program that's what it covers. The program that the county's committee that's been put together began with King County as a kind of, okay, how did they do it? And those were kind of the categories that we went over back in the fall that included a list of different ways they were classifying historic properties. just to kind of go, so just so you understand and see all the different ways that the King County at least is looking at the rating system is, you know, everywhere from linkages to trails to watershed protection, and each one of those has a point value. So one property could have multiple of these items and adds up to a total, which then dictates what the value or the benefit would be. So that's that. So their historic categories that we were looking at, they had historic or archaeological landmark, a designated site as a high priority. And they, King County is a little bit different than us as we look more into it. They are like us where they have a King County program that, and they also have interlocal agreements with some of the smaller cities, but then also Seattle has their own preservation program. So they may have multiple, local registers that are regulatory. So there's, which is different from us. So the way they kind of defined it is, you know, the King County Register or other local register designations would qualify for this, as well as archaeological sites that have been designated by the state. Their second one is an eligible site, and as we talked about, they have a historic preservation officer, which can determine that, and that was one of our hang-ups was how are we, if we kind of use that similar phrase, how would we determine what's eligible? So that was a question we had. And then the third one there is a buffer to a designated historic or archaeological site, and the question was like, well, what does that mean and how would that be done? So they also had these bonus and super bonus categories that we did talk about as well that not only are related to historic but could be related to some of those other categories that I showed before. So in kind of getting more deep into it, so when we spoke last, and then we have our committee that's been also looking at this, which is Andy, Sean, and Alex. When I last spoke with you, we had kind of picked six. So we had our, those with highest priority was the designated on the local register. Medium would be those on the national or the Washington Heritage Register. Another medium would be contributing properties within any of those. The buffer to a designated site, we weren't quite sure. A historic resource view shed, and then the eligible to be on, which we still weren't sure how that would work. So after kind of looking more and doing more research and hearing back from the committee onto, we're kind of confused and this kind of makes more sense to us, I've tried to consolidate them and be more simple, at least for this first kind of like this is how it could work. So that's why I wanted to propose to you all tonight to see what your feedback might be or your initial thoughts. So what I've brought to the subcommittee's attention is what if we did, okay, the first one, the highest priority, of course, for us is preserving historic sites in the county, and we can do that by putting properties on the local register, which has that regulatory protection. So that's like the high one, right, as well as archaeological sites. So those, you know, easily, it's either on the register or it's not, they get the point value to that. If it's on the archaeological designation inventory, the state knows that can happen very simply. Then I was thinking about this eligible in the National Register and the Washington Heritage Register, and my thought was, and it's kind of how King County does it as well. They allow these other registers to get the benefit on the eligible side. If it's listed on the National Register here in Clark County or the Washington Heritage Register or the Washington Barn Register, I would, in my mind, it's most likely eligible to be on the Clark County Heritage Register. So thinking of kind of implementation-wise, that's an easy way to be yes or no. It's eligible. It's not going to get as many points because we want to encourage people to list it. So it should get some, but if you put it on the register, you get more. Right. But it's an easy way to administer it because you know exactly there's no process involved. It's either yes or no. So that's kind of the thought. That's one thing I kind of wanted to see what you all felt about that kind of idea of definition for eligible. Is that kind of something that you all – makes sense to you?
Yeah, it's very black and white.
Okay. Because I think that's easy for people to understand. I mean, outside of our world, like when we go out to the public, to be like, okay, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, great.
Easy to administer, no negotiation involved, yeah.
Right, right. Okay, great. So that's what I'm going to kind of keep moving forward. The third one, so I'm going down to three. So either you're on the register, you're eligible, and then there's this buffer category. So King County, they deem it a medium priority, and they kind of give some examples. So I did my maps, and I kind of looked around at some of our historic sites, and how would this work? And it's not going to be a whole bunch of property owners that are going to benefit from this, right? Because it has to be specific, and there has to be a buffer to the historic sites. But for example, like the farm, the Heritage Farm, so it's kind of hard to see, but that's, you know, the big triangle there. And then there's this tract of land right to, you know, the east of it that's not developed, but it probably will be eventually. But if they buffered a portion of it that was adjacent to the property, they could potentially apply and get the category, the points for buffering. So I think it's something to still talk about because that could be beneficial for some properties such as this, and maybe more so in the rural area as urban growth boundaries expand and you're getting closer to those farmsteads, a way to kind of buffer that kind of rural feeling of that historic site and protect it a bit more. So
this example, would a buffer mean that they would still have a fence on their property line? They would just have land on the other side that isn't developed?
I mean, right. It would be.
It have to be a contiguous no fence. No.
It doesn't seem like that's how. It seems like it would be kind of a specific, you know, area that's designated.
You don't put a building right at
the right. Point. Right.
Kind of like
right.
A setback limit.
It's kind of like, yeah, so they were gonna, it's like a, you know, they're saying that they're never going to develop that as they are in this program and as they get this benefit. So,
I mean, in this example, I could see that being a benefit because we've seen what kind of problems we have with the property owners that are adjacent to the farm on the west side.
Right.
You know, there's been a lot of, as we know, you know, kind of disputes over that property line and the cemetery and all
yeah.
of that.
Yes.
Would have been a good idea.
Yes, definitely.
Is there an opportunity for a public question?
Sure. Come on up, Holly.
Sure. The right type of that. What was the green light?
Okay. Yeah.
So,
Brad would like 2 minutes. Leave us alone.
Sure. So you're thinking of a buffer as only in a rural area?
No. This
okay.
is just an example.
Okay.
I'm thinking that it's
I'm
probably
thinking like, what if a buffer was an adjacent building on a main street, for example?
It could.
So you just kind of need to think about how that might
yep.
play out.
Yes.
But no, because it could be a not particularly significant building historically, but might have the right massing to help, you know, save the feeling of a main street. And also I'm wondering in this one, by historic or archaeological site, are you referring to the previous categories that it would either be designated or it would be eligible and those would be the things that would be
buffers. Yes.
Okay.
And it's looking at King County and I don't know why, but for some, and I will call and talk to them about it, but mm-hmm. they specify that it's only for designated sites that are also enrolled in their program. Which for me, I'd rather just, you know, if mm-hmm. you're eligible or designated and you're buffering, that's a good mm-hmm. thing. So I don't know if there's some kind of administrative issue that's why they did that, but for, I mean, my initial is like, who cares? Like, all sites that are either mm-hmm. eligible or designated mm-hmm. should be preserved and buffered if possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, your buffer could be a building and it could be a wetland.
Well, exactly. This was obviously a rural example, so I was just curious if a buffer theoretically could apply in an urban setting.
Yeah. I mean, because this is kind of, I mean, this is not suburban, but I mean, it's, you know, it's getting there. I mean, I know this lot's under, you know, it's got the development sign on it. It's, you know, there's going to be a big bunch of houses that are going to come right there. And like Sarah said, if we had something like that there, people wouldn't be so close to living right on the edge of the cemetery, perhaps.
And so could a buffer also potentially be the land around a historic structure?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, usually you can only deduct the value of the property directly underneath the building.
Right.
So theoretically, if you had a farm, you could declare some kind of buffer around it.
I think so. And
just kind of thinking.
Right. Oh, yeah, I think that's
I love
definitely.
This idea,
yeah.
But I wanted, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think in the way it's like, so whatever area it is, you know, you can, mm-hmm. whatever you do outside of it, uh-huh. you're not getting benefit. It's mm-hmm. contained to mm-hmm. whatever it is that mm-hmm. supposed to be preserved.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have to look at, like, how they...
Because I'm just thinking, because you could have, say, a farm site that where it had a larger acreage than the buildings themselves, that then maybe that other land becomes a buffer...
To that the you would property?
Yeah, that you wouldn't previously have been able to claim because the open space refers to things underneath the buildings directly.
Well, I think, I don't know, because, I mean, if it was a historic site, like, mm-hmm. and it would, like, say the farm was mm-hmm. not, it was out wherever, mm-hmm. That whole site is protected.
Mm-hmm.
So it could, in my mind, the whole thing, mm-hmm. the whole 100 acres,
right.
would be, get the benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Not just like,
but it hasn't up to this time, has it?
No, it does. It's just the soils,
right?
But it's
right.
the soils of the property.
Yeah,
they don't. So if and everyone gets the same, mm-hmm. same for everybody. If okay. you're mm-hmm. if you're doing historic site, if it's a park, if it's an open space, it's mm-hmm. whatever your soil is how mm-hmm. they calculate mm-hmm. the value.
Mm-hmm.
So
this could actually help. Save some additional properties if people were not wanting to designate their own property, but to be on the Clark County Register, but perhaps they went to the you know the Washington Heritage Register, the Barn Register. You mm-hmm. still might end up saving more properties yep. than you would otherwise. And I think it also mitigates the idea that you're needing to make up the additional tax revenue from adjacent properties that plays into special valuation. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, just interesting.
Yeah, no, keep them coming. If things come up, just send me questions yeah. so that, because, I mean, we need this part of the discussion. It's going to go out to the public eventually, mm-hmm. but right now we're just kind of vetting, like, how it would work,
mm-hmm.
what would happen, you know, with what we have now and the transition
right.
and things like that. So,
yeah. What's the buffer zone? Is it, like, the greater of some minimum?
There, I think it would be case by case, and it seems like, you know, you have to send someone out there to kind of gauge it. And be like, okay, this buffer would preserve it, and then it would have to be like surveyed.
I think to the extent that can be objective,
mm-hmm.
clear as possible.
Yeah. Yes, I agree.
We spent a lot of time on this buffer thing. Was it last month?
I mean, it was, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So okay. So pretty much that's so those would be the three now. Designated, eligible, and buffer. I mean, just to move forward with, to go to like the initial, like, okay, county council, this is kind of at least the historic. There's tons of other categories, but these would be the historic categories. Those, I think the bonus and the super bonus needs to come later when we figure out everything else. So that's kind of would be the next phase. So that's kind of all I had. I just want to keep you all up to date on that and kind of get a head nod that makes sense. So that I can bring that back to the PBRS committee and be like, this is the three we want to start with.
It seems like you've taken some really complicated rulemaking and tried to streamline it and
yep.
make it make sense. So that's
yeah. Yeah. And make it make sense for us here and what we do and in our processes, too. So, yeah. Thanks for hanging in there with me and bearing with me on all of this. So, okay.
I've got one update. So I went to see the Lions Club in Battleground last week, and there was about, yes, there was about 25 people that showed up, and they allowed me to go first on their agenda, which was nice. I wasn't able to do a slideshow, but I had all the handouts that I handed them that were similar to our traveling tour that we did last year. Actually, a lot of people were really interested. I did a quick survey at the beginning to ask how many people in the room had homes that were over 50 years old, and probably most of the people in the room raised their hands, and so it got them thinking. Asked any how many people had barns that they thought were over 50 years old, and there was a few hands that went up. One person in the room, and I'm forgetting the name of the property, but she was actually one of the owners of the homes that was listed. So she was able to provide some more details on the homes. I asked her if she could make it open to the public, though. So she said, just my friends. She wasn't offering it even to her Lion Club folks, by the way. So interesting. I know. Good interest. I don't know if anyone followed up with you. I made sure and let them know that.
Not yet.
Okay. And if they had questions, they should call staff and whatnot. So it was a good presentation. People were interested. It just made me think that we should probably reach out to a few groups that, if we can, maybe just to get a few more dates on the calendar, just to keep this kind of traveling program alive. I don't know how many of us actually, so we don't just lose it. Because it just seems to me like, especially like when we had a neighborhood like Hauk come to us last week, we have other neighborhoods that have historic buildings, and it would be nice to start really spreading the word that it doesn't have to be a neighborhood, but it can be those individual structures.
An idea would be, which could kind of springboard other, at least, is to we could present to the Neighborhood Association Council of Clark County, and Vancouver also has kind of a
Vancouver Neighborhood Association.
Yes, too. Yeah, that then you could spread the word through their chairs and see if there would be interest in other neighborhoods, getting information from us. So that's an idea.
I could reach out. I do know the chair of the Vancouver's Neighborhood Association. I could reach out to her and see if we could be put on the agenda. I don't know the but you
yeah, yeah, we can. Yes. Yep.
Okay. So I could follow up with that.
Okay.
And see if there's an agenda date, and even if it's not one, I could still represent you at the meeting if it's not in the next 2 months before I leave.
Okay.
But I'll find out.
Okay.
Okay. That's all I have.
Okay. So the last thing is our next edition of the rules and procedures update. So last month I kind of went into detail on the bylaws because I changed so much. So I don't plan on going through it bit by bit. So it's similar to what it was. We just tried to clean up what actually processes we did. Some of the things just didn't make the language that we use was not how it was reflected, and then just making sure it was the same kind of language that we have in our code section. So like if there is a special meeting, you know what the process is for that, and how are the steps that occur after a nomination is approved, and the findings and how that's distributed and that it's recorded and things that need to have happened. So if you guys have any questions for us on what you've seen, we're happy to answer anything.
So is this kind of the first step? Are we going by it part by part? I think so.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm a little behind the time.
Sorry. So you remember this thing that's probably in your binder that we gave you. So it's like it's all our different processes for our different processes. So it explains the procedures for each. So what happens when kind of step by step a property is listed on the Clark County Heritage Register? So what happens before the meeting? You know, what does the applicant have to do? What does staff do? And then what does the commission do at their meeting and afterward? And then same as for when we do a certificate of appropriateness and the process for that. So we're chunking it out so it's not so much all at once. So last month, at the beginning of this booklet, it's the bylaws. So I pretty much went to, because they were kind of bylaws, but they didn't include everything, I went to DAP, Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, and looked at their bylaws template and just tried to kind of include all the things that should be included for a commission or for a board as a bylaw. So that's what we kind of went through last month. So we got some feedback on that, and I've made some edits. We're kind of put a pause on some of it because there's some discussion with the city on their appointment process and whether or not they want to appoint members themselves to the commission. So that I'm kind of putting that on hold until we clarify and figure out how that's going to work. So every month that we don't have a huge amount on the agenda, we're going to try to bring forward the changes so we update this to match what we did with the code update last year and just bring it more up to what we're doing and how we work here with the commission. So it'll help not only applicants so they know kind of what to expect. It'll help, like, if Sharon and I are no longer here and a new staff or new city staff, like, this is how the commission, the joint commission works. So that's pretty much. But it is, we do vote on it at a hearing, so at the end it'll be, you know, official action.
Okay.
So I had some feedback for the procedures that you prepared for this evening.
Okay.
And just kind of thinking out loud here with the group. So over the last, over the years that I've been on this commission, there have been occasions where we get these nomination packets and it's pretty much, okay, here it is. Now we're in a position where we have to vote it up, vote it down, or, you know, specify certain amendments made, right? And I've offered on a couple of occasions that it's done differently in the state of Oregon. There's actually a period of time where the nominations are received well ahead of the public hearing, and then they actually get forwarded to the commission members. Commission members have an opportunity to read through it and then kind of provide that feedback ahead of time, right? So you get some of the improvement in what we're voting on ahead of time. And I'm just wondering if that isn't a practice that would be good for us. Because, you know, I think of some of the nominations that have come before us and we've had to be fairly critical of them. And then you're stuck in this position of, okay, well, is it good enough for the Heritage Register? Do we just kind of approve it as is, or do we send it back, right? And I think if we do have an opportunity then to review them ahead of time and offer comments, then that could help with that process.
Okay. Yeah. And would you be offering comments over email to Jessica, or how would you would it be?
Well, if I receive a PDF document ahead of time, so let's say it's 60 days before the scheduled hearing, right? Then I can take that PDF document and I can comment within, right, using Adobe Acrobat or Adobe Reader, and just kind of say, hey, if I'm Alex and I see something that doesn't seem to be appropriately architecturally notated, then I can provide that feedback ahead of time.
And then give it to the applicant.
And then, yeah.
Return
and then,
to the applicant.
Right. Then staff sends it to the applicant. Hey, we received these. The applicant doesn't have to make those changes, but it improves their chances of getting their nomination approved. Right.
Currently require like 30 days in advance, and staff does that review. So Parkersville is an example where we didn't think that it was ready. It wouldn't have been approved, and so that's when we got funding and we brought on a consultant to bolster that. Like, we do that scrutiny.
Right, because I just think we have some members on our commission right now that have very strong opinions about certain issues, be it archaeology or be it windows.
No, I fully
circles around themselves.
Yeah,
you know?
I fully accept that there is some risk in the process. The other is staff shouldn't be chasing down commission members to get their comments in, right? I think that there's a window, either you do or you don't, and if you miss that opportunity, then too late. But you're you're right. You know, you could have two people who with, you know, polar opposite opinions on certain things and the wording, and that's just going to add confusion to the applicant. So I don't know. All I'm saying is that that's how it's done across the river, and it seems to work well over there. I think there's pros and cons each way.
So if you, in code, we have the 30-day submittal, so just to keep in mind that that's in, so we'd have to amend that. Yeah. And I'm sure previous commissions and how this program was set up was, you know, you don't want applicants to wait too long. You know, you're trying to be as efficient as possible with their time. Most probably that's more so with the certificate of appropriateness, right, because they're trying to get something done and they're on other schedules versus the nomination. But that's, you know, they all have the same kind of timeline as that 30-day submittal before they want to be on.
Maybe it's we don't write it up. Maybe it's just an informal process.
It could be.
If you would like commissioner ahead of time.
Yeah.
Offered as a service.
Because we could always do kind of like, you know, a work session as well if they were, you know, up for that, where you get it ahead of time even and they could be here to listen to comments that you give. Or you could do it just written and we give the pass it along.
Or maybe just one commission member raises their hand and, you know, you say, okay, we have a nomination coming before us. Is there anybody who would like to offer some assistance and read it ahead of time? I don't know. Food for thought.
Well, it's probably something that the full commission should probably weigh in on if it is going to, you know, change the kind of current process. So, and these are good discussions to have. So how about like things like this we should kind of put aside and have, you know, as we move this along, because it's going to be a similar theme for other processes that we are going to talk about. And let's see what everyone wants to do.
Yeah, and just as we were talking there, I think Sarah halfway talked me out of that idea just because, you know, okay, the window discussion and it's like, how do you manage that?
Okay. Is there anything else that popped out at anybody that they wanted to highlight or bring up? So I know through the, you know, years we've talked about certain things that you want to for sure see in a nomination, like the references and citations and we did have some application standards in the current rules and procedures. So we've been talking about doing, kind of beefing that up to have some, you know, really detailed tips and how to put together your nomination and have an example in it that shows, like, how to cite and what the commission will be looking for to help people with their filling the application out. So that will come also.
Jackie,
yes,
I wondered what you meant by the section where it's talking about publicity after something is listed.
Uh-huh.
The phrase, I think, was sending something out as relevant. And I was wondering if that meant archaeological sites. Okay.
If appropriate. Do you think we should specify that?
Well, I know. I was assuming it was about the archaeology, yeah. But I also was thinking you might still want to come up with some way to publicize the fact that the commission is protecting underground resources or historic above-ground archaeological resources, even if you can't tell the public where they are.
Yeah.
But just it might be a perfectly useful phrase, but I was just sort of wondering if there might be some way to take note that archaeology was part of the program.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's all we have. So for next month, we don't have any cases.
Okay.
The city may.
We have an overlay, something in the overlay.
We don't have any cases, and we very likely won't have an update or anything yet at all on the demolition committee either. We have subcommittees that are, we have no active subcommittees really. Then.
So we were thinking to just bring more sections of the rules and procedures and just hit it there, so that we can go faster through it.
I will. I like. I I've mentioned, I'm already, I have a conference I'm supposed to go to, so I won't be here. So Alex will be running the meeting. He already expressed his, oh my goodness. It's like, well, that's what vice chair does.
Jan mentioned that they're putting together a proposal to put a kitchen in the Slocum House.
I should be here. I can kind of help.
Can help him.
Okay. Help there's a proposal to put a kitchen.
He'll be fine.
Yeah.
All right.
There could be a couple other items.
There could be.
Yes. So the overlay does not require the 30-day, so he could still get in some requests. And I know there's some floating out there. And then Jan's mentioned that the Slocum House may get a kitchen that she probably may want coming to talk to you about in May.
Okay. And I guess we might also need some volunteers if I come back with some dates on
yes. On presentations.
Presentations. Yeah. And we also... I don't know if we want to do it next meeting or the meeting that I'm back at, but we were going to, once our other committees finish their work, we were going to recruit for our next committee on. So we have
the demo committee is done and the interview committee is done.
Mm-hmm.
And rules and procedures is now a group, so we've freed up all these.
Right. So we can move forward with basically updating our online app with our intangible resources committee. I know Alex was thinking he wanted to be on that committee as well, so we can definitely recruit another committee to get working on that, which would be cool. All right. Do we have any more old business and updates?
I have one small item. That in response to the chair of the HPC, Sarah Fox,
mm-hmm.
the city of Vancouver is going to delay their bicycle lane improvement program. So I thought that was interesting, and I hope our visitor from last month, Ms. McCarter, is very happy about this.
Is this delay for more consideration?
Yes. Yes. They did not make a decision on it.
They decided they would spend another year, do more outreach.
Smart.
Yes.
Based on. You must have written a very persuasive letter.
It was all me, right, yeah.
No, no,
or
sorry.
All our committee, yeah. Our
I
committee.
Just wanted to make sure I got
just
that.
The one letter, that was it, yeah.
So, yeah, Sharon briefly mentioned something about that last meeting, but I wasn't here, Michelle wasn't here, so maybe you could give us a quick update.
Oh, well.
Andy and I were here.
As it happens.
Just a quick one.
There was a Hauk neighborhood resident who was dismayed over the prospect of the fact that there would be no more on-street parking, that there were restrictions in improvement to outbuildings like those standalone garages, which you had to require a setback. So they won't allow you to improve your garage, and they won't allow you to park on the street either. And so they were also worried about markers of the sidewalks and curbs were built. They have not been maintained as the ADA sidewalks and crossings are being implemented. And so the City of Vancouver was imminently going to vote on this program for bike lanes that would disrupt the character of. Visitor probably felt as if
she was heard, and
she was heard, yeah. And something happened that in response. So I thought that was
that's great.
Yes, yeah. Our letter, Sharon wrote the letter. I really didn't add too much to it, but it was
signature.
I signed it. Yes, she captured what we had said at the meeting really well. And
well done, everybody. That was I thought that was a significant piece of work.
There is, you know, there is concern that, which we stated in our letter to the City of Vancouver, that, you know, there have been quite a few projects just in my short 6 years on this commission that they've gone forward with without checking with us. And, you know, there are neighborhoods that have, like the Hauk, that have a historic designation, you know, in our other downtown areas with the bus transit transit shelters that, you know, suddenly are, you know, don't at all out of character with it. So our letter did urge the City of Vancouver to include us in any of their upcoming developments in our in historic areas. So hopefully they start to do that because really, I mean, especially with this bike project, you know, it wasn't, I went to a lot of the neighborhood meetings out of my own personal interest, but they were, they're planning to take all of the on-street parking off of all the way the entire stretch of Columbia from 40th downtown. And as everyone knows who's driven along that stretch or lives along that stretch, there's quite a few homes that don't have driveways. And so,
right.
So they're either going to cut into their yards, create, you know, a new driveway or off-street parking for their own property, or they will demolish these garages that are already abutting the property line. A lot of these older homes have garages that are right up to the edge. So she had very valid concerns about what this could do to change the neighborhood, what we would see driving down that road.
Yeah. Yeah. No, good work.
All right. So
that you bring up the transit centers. I mean, mm-hmm. I was down there trying to take a picture of the savings and loan building. And there's just no way to get a really clear picture of that building anymore without that transit center in there. And yeah. That was outside of our overlay area.
Yeah.
And, you know, we fought tooth and claw just for that one transit center. But, yeah, it's terrible.
No, they didn't listen to us whatsoever. So we have public comment tonight. Do you have anything either of you to
get ask? It all off your chest there, Holly?
Okay. One, I haven't had a chance to come and thank the commission for the support for our first Thursday program. We really appreciated that from the museum, just having that continuing support to be able to do that. And as a result, we're going to be taking the program, you know, to offsite. The next one will be in May that we'll do up at the Old Liberty Theater in Ridgefield, Washington, and it's going to be a start of a series that we'll do each year called Celebrate Main Street, and we're essentially going to highlight all of the historic properties on Main Street, their history, and who is involved in continuing to keep those alive today. And then tomorrow evening we have a wonderful talk by one of the commissioners here on Mr. J.P. Kiggins and his theater, so also we want to thank Commissioner Gregg for doing that.
I want to thank you for digitizing that.
Yes, it is. It's fully digitized and ready to go. So, yeah, we've been watching it, and it's pretty neat.
There is some pretty amazing footage.
You've got another talk?
Pardon me?
You're doing another talk?
I am.
All right. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, tomorrow evening at the museum at 7 p.m., he'll be doing that for our first Thursday. Right. And then also for your outreach efforts, if you ever want to do a seminar or any kind of talk where you want to centralize, the museum's always an open opportunity for you to use at no charge. We would just open that up and then use that as a partnership between the museum to communicate to our groups that there's some kind of, you know, if you want to talk about how to do a register, if you want to talk about the benefits of having a property on, you know, the historic register, just what the commission does, please let us know. We want to make sure to do that. And then also in May we'll be putting up the historic plaque on the medical arts building or arts building. And so we want to continue to partner with you on those and kind of find some time to talk on the side about more solid partnership on getting those plaques that we have some funding for to do around the county. We have one that's already up on Hauk, and it's thanks because of the designation of Hauk as a historic neighborhood that we have a plaque up on the Hauk school. So if you want to see an example, you can go check that one out. And that's it.
I have one thing for you.
Yeah.
To pop quiz you on this, but it was brought up. Sharon and I had shared a few emails back and forth about the Green Book when it the movie came out, that there's actually a site in Vancouver that's listed in the Green Book.
Green Book.
The Green Book's the book that started in the New York area that provided safe lodging and places for our Black Americans.
Oh.
And then it expanded all over. Washington, and pretty much it seems like they probably found places that were, you know, where you needed to stop for the night. So there's only about four or five in the entire state of Washington, but there was one in Vancouver, and I drilled down to try to figure out exactly where it was, and it looks like it's near the kind of where the apartment buildings are, right off Main Street and 39th. But I'm, you know, I'm not a historian researcher myself, so that's about as far as I got, and I thought I was wondering if you guys had actually looked into this at all.
No, but if you want to send me.
I'll send you the link, because we last month, the National Trust for Historic Preservation had a series on this.
It used to be.
There's a movie coming out, but they don't do it justice. And so they were saying, here's actually the history of this, and they have links to the all the green books, all the volumes and editions, and that's where we looked up, Washington had sites. And these were informal places, like Airbnb before the day.
Yeah.
You could just open up your house and...
And you could, yeah.
People could know it, so it was safe passage because there was a lot of segregation, discrimination in the North.
Yeah.
You didn't know what to, where could you eat, where could you stay.
I was hoping it was safe.
And it's really interesting.
Yeah, send that our way. We'll dig into that and see what we can find.
Yeah, I'll try to find. There were some videos that were really interesting.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, okay, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So I was going to let you know the app.
Yes.
It's getting close to being.
Cool, good. Good to hear.
And we can sit down and talk about it.
Okay.
We can see in the future how we might be able to utilize data. One of the ways that I might do that is that the NIH, there's kind of like a data card you start off with that gives you this information.
Yep.
We might put some of the sites for the nominations,
great.
And maybe some of the nominations at the bottom, say if you want to know more about the site, this is a great resource to look into.
Great.
So I'll let you know as we're going through, and then as we get it launched, we can figure out if there's a way to feed data in or whatever we could do to continue that. But that'll be all ready to go.
Awesome. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Sharon, Andy actually knows exactly where the site is.
Wow.
And the family.
It's where WDOT is on 40th and Main. It was formerly known as the Sleep Off the Highway Motel.
Still there?
No.
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 But it was, in fact, when I was a kid, our neighbor owned it. And it was a family with six girls. And as they got to be high school age, they all worked there.
There now.
Pardon me?
WDOT.
WDOT. Oh.
That's what I'm.
Yeah.
But if you were to look up in New York, it was probably there until about 1970. Mm. It was there in the 60s.
I'm probably in the Sanborns, you'd be able to find it, right?
Pardon?
You'd be able to find it in the Sanborns.
Yeah, or a phone directory. You know, you have the old direct phone directories.
If you
look up at Sleep Off the Highway Motel, and it was a classic auto port.
If we dig into this, should do an article for the annual.
Well, it would be amazing because I think because of such, you know, like I said, they're,
the movie
generated a lot of interest, and then.
And we could talk to them. I mean, the daughter, but they're right. The youngest daughter was.
That could go on our website. That
You have to write another
article. Write that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't think of it until you were just explaining where it was. And I thought the irony is, and I told Sarah, it was across the street from the Jefferson Davis Memorial.
It is. That's exactly where that site is.
It's across from Covington House.
And who knows, it might not have been a coincidence.
Yeah.
It might not have been a coincidence. Yeah.
Yeah, send me that link and then we'll start some more.
Okay. Is what that monument
I'll pass them off to our editor.
I'm pretty sure the monument was put up in the 60s, wasn't it? The Jefferson Davis?
I think so.
Oh, and that hotel would have...
Well, there were, I think it might have been because it was somewhere else, and then maybe it was moved to Covington, right?
I don't...
Interesting. Well, just...
I'm only going to comment what I know for sure.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Just...
Like Flynn's for anything.
Before we close, David Parker attended this meeting tonight.
Okay.
Hey, David Parker.
Ooh. Interesting.
That was interesting. Right.
Well, that's all I...
No Van Vliet.
Didn't mean to go down a whole nother route there.
It was interesting.
But he was here and
thought
about it. Okay. So do we have any other public comments tonight? No? Okay. Anything else from the commission? All right. So I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Any seconds?
I second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. We are adjourned. Thank you.
The Golden Weather in Portland was still there.
Is that building still there?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen John Tuttle? John John Tuttle's documentary for OPB called Local Color?
Yeah.
Yeah, they just mentioned it.
Yeah, right now.
Hey, Brad. I was boning up.